Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of MixerG, where I interview entrepreneurs for an audience of real entrepreneurs who want to find out how others did it because they're looking for ideas that they can use to build up their companies. And I've got to tell you that I had an opportunity to interview the guests you're about to meet, but I don't know if I'd say I punked out of it before, but I definitely didn't follow up on it. And the reason that I didn't follow up on it, and Evan, I'm even wondering if you remember this. The reason I didn't follow up on it is because, well, here's how I found out about Evan Pagan. Laura Roeder, an entrepreneur who I interviewed back in 2011, told me that she understood how to create online courses by watching this guy, Evan Pagan, by going to one of his programs, by learning from him. And then she built up this online course that did really well. And then from there, she moved on to software called Meet Edgar, which did really well. And through that, I realized there are a lot of people who know Evan Pagan. And when my audience knows my guest better than I do, when they're fascinated by my guest so much that they study his life, know his wife's name, there's a point where I have to say I can't add much to it and I'm only going to look inferior to my audience in this. And so I didn't know the angle. And so when he and I talked a while back, I asked him, would you do an interview? He said yes, but ping me about it. I never followed up because of that reason. Well, so why am I having him on today? Because look at this. I now know more than you guys. This is his book, his latest book, Opportunity. It's about what opportunity is, how it works, where to find it. And I got a copy of it before just about everyone else in the audience. I'm going to say before every single other person in the audience. I spent an hour, 45 minutes reading it, not because it's a light read. It actually will take you guys longer, but because I'm an experienced interviewer who has to learn how to read fast. And I got a lot out of it. And so I invited him on here to talk about opportunity, how to find it, and what's in this book. And more specifically, to tell his story of how he got his start in business, and he had a really tough background, how he went from that to building up this business that helped Laura Roeder, and how he used the ideas in this book to do it. So his name is Evan Pagan. He is now the founder of so many companies, it's a little hard to describe. So what I'll do is I'll say he started out as a musician, long-haired musician. You wouldn't know it by looking at him now. He then became a real estate guy. And by that, I mean, he did a few things, including teach people how to get more clients in real estate. He then moved on, and this is where he really got his reputation, into the dating advice space. I feel like he conquered it, became one of the biggest names in the space. And from there, he moved on to teaching people about entrepreneurship. Many of you guys learned from him. And more recently, he's become an investor in several startups. We'll find out about how he did all of that thanks to two great sponsors. The first will host your website, right? It's called HostGator. And the second will help you get your next great developer. It's called TopTal. But I'll tell you about those later. Evan, welcome.
Thank you, Andrew. That was a fun introduction.
Yeah, I try to like tap into what's real for me. What do I care about in the intro, and not just follow along with what's given to me. I'm going to do the same thing with the first question. I'm really curious about like what you do now, and I hate to say it this way, but I'm an interviewer, so I'm allowed to. How much money you make? Give me a sense of size here.
You mean of my businesses?
Yeah.
Sure. Well, it's a little bit complex because I have several companies that I'm, an owner and a partner in, and I have several that I've invested in. But I started my business online, 15, 16 years ago. I grew it. We got up to $20, $30 million a year. About 4 or 5 years ago, I broke that main business into three pieces, and I took on partners, people that had worked with me for years. So it's a little bit more complex, but I'm going to say that those three businesses now, a couple of them do like in the 5 to 10 million range. One of them is maybe more in the single digit millions for that one. Plus, I'm an investor in a lot of different companies, and I have a couple of other startups I'm working on myself.
It seems to me like a lot of this growth happened because of a $1 tape that you bought. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
What's the $1 tape? Where'd you get it, and how did it influence your life?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Oregon. I grew up in the sticks out in the woods of Oregon to hippie parents, and I had no real success role models. I didn't know any rich people. I didn't really know anybody who knew any rich people. I was a long-haired rock and roll guitar player. I dropped out of high school when I was 16. I went to a local community college. I dropped out of that to go on tour with a rock band. When I was 22, it finally kind of really occurred to me that music was not going to work for me. At my height, I made $75 a week as a guitar player. And I reasoned that people that had a lot of money had either made it in real estate or then put it in real estate. So it seemed like real estate had this common denominator. So I went and I got a real estate license, which back in those days meant you go into a little room, you listen to cassette tapes for months, and then you go take a test and then you never use anything that you learned on the test, or, you know. And so there I was with my two-door Camaro with my ponytail trying to get people to buy and sell real estate. And that was a real challenge. I didn't do very well. I only sold 1 1/3 homes my first year, and I made less money than I was making at my my manual labor job. And I wasn't figuring out sales, and so I had to go learn about it. And one of the seminars that I went to, one day I got these tickets in my inbox, and they said like $97 value, but because you're a real estate agent, you get to come to this seminar for free. You know, I didn't know anything about marketing back then. I didn't realize this was a thing where they're going to be selling stuff. So I go to this seminar. There's a guy named Joe Stumpf on stage, and he's teaching how to get referrals from your clients and basically how to do sales and marketing. And he was like the most charismatic, just the best communicator I'd ever seen. I'd never really seen anybody quite like this. I was blown away. I went up to him at the end afterwards, and I tried to talk to him, and he kind of didn't see me. You know, I'm this kind of goofy looking kid. But back then, I used to also, I mean, I grew up with, you know, parents on government assistance. We couldn't drive by a secondhand store or a garage sale without stopping and dragging things home. So I used to go to the Goodwill stores and the Salvation Army and these kinds of things looking for stuff myself. And I would go in and, you know, I'd find a book that I would buy for $1 or for 50 cents. And then I'd go sell it at the bookstore down the, you know, down the road for like 10 bucks to, you know, make enough money for gas and food. Like this is where I was at. You know, I was making like $6 to maybe $10 an hour at my job at that point. And one day I went into the Goodwill store, I remember, in West Eugene. And by the way, at the seminar, I couldn't afford to buy the tapes because they were, you know, like a couple hundred bucks, or maybe the high end seminar was like $500. It was just way outside my price range. So I'm in the Goodwill store, and I look on this rack, and there's one of the tape sets from this guy that I had seen speak, and they were $1. And so instead of $100, you know, there they are. And I couldn't believe my luck. I felt like I had won the lottery. So I grabbed these tapes and I go running over, and then I go to my manual labor job, where I worked as an apprentice for a coppersmith in a metal shop. And I used to use this pneumatic hammer that would hammer copper, and I would wear these earmuffs. And so I'd put on my headset and I'd put the little earbuds under the earmuffs, and I would just listen to these tapes over and over. And there were other self-help tapes that I would listen to sometimes, but these in particular, there was just so many ideas in there that got my brain going for doing marketing and sales. And so, of course, then I would go back to that Goodwill every time I was anywhere near it. And like, you know, a month later, there was another set of these tapes also for $1. And, you know, then I'm thinking, okay, lightning strikes twice, you know, I won the lottery twice. And so just kept listening to these. And at some point I realized this guy who's teaching, Joe Stumpf, he's got ideas unlike any that I've ever heard. So I started calling his company on the phone, and I started making friends with his telemarketers. I would just call them up and talk to them and ask them what's going on. And every once in a while, they'd like slip me one of his more advanced tapes, you know, like from the coaching program that he'd have. And one of them had him and Jay Abraham on it. And I'll never forget it. I just listened to that tape over and over, because these two guys were on another wavelength, you know, and I could tell they were doing something really important. And so I made friends with his telemarketers. I went up to one of his other half-day seminars that he had in Portland, Oregon. And bottom line, I kept trying to figure out what could I do to maybe figure out a way to work with these guys. And one day I was listening to one of their tapes, and I realized that the sound quality was not very good. And I had a background. I was a long-haired rock and roll guitar player. I had recorded albums and things. And I called up and I said, hey, maybe I could help you make your tapes sound better. Maybe I could help you make your audio. And they said, you know, our audio guy just quit. And so they connected me to the general manager on the phone, and he said, well, why don't you come up to our big seminar and, you know, do our audio visual. And I went and did that, and I just, you know, tried to do the best job that I could. And there's a couple of other fun stories there if you really want to dive in, but yeah.
You were calling them up so much that they were slipping you, the telemarketers were, the people who were picking up the phone, slipping you free copies of his tapes because they knew how much of a fan you were?
Oh yeah, I would call them all the time. I mean, I was just calling these people up because they, you know, they worked with the smartest guy that I had found. And in fact, they would send me tapes and I would send them stuff as well. One day I went to the Goodwill store and there was a set of Tony Robbins' Personal Power.
Yep.
The whole thing. And it was like $5 or something, wow. You know, and it was like all the, you know, the cassette tapes. And I sent it to one of his telemarketers as a gift because they were being cool to me. And so, you know, I found this and I sent it to them. And so, yeah, I was just, you know, making friends as the best I could.
And then you got a job because you called them up. You asked if you can help. This is one of the key ideas in the book, Opportunity. Explain that.
Yeah. I think of opportunity You know, the dictionary defines opportunity as being a favorable juncture of circumstances, which kind of puts opportunity out there. It's like something that happens out there in the world. I like to look at opportunity as being an act of creativity. It's something that you create. It's you go to situations and you figure out how to make it into an opportunity. My wife and I talk about this a lot when we have conflicts or fights or there's an upset in our family. If you remember that this has happened now and this is an opportunity to build our relationship even stronger, then it's different. It's not the same. And when you go and do the repair and you work through your apologies and you listen to how it affected the other person, you know, it can bond you. So I think of opportunity as being something that you bring creativity to. It's something that you go and it's an act that you do. It's an act of will in life. And that the more you practice creative opportunity making or creative opportunity discovery, the better you get at it and the more of it you have and the higher the quality of the opportunities you can create.
You know, speaking of the book and also speaking of the fact that you can get it pretty inexpensive speaking of getting things that are valuable inexpensively, I should say that you're offering the book for free at freeopportunitybook.com. People just have to pay for shipping. I meant to say that in the intro, but freeopportunitybook.com for anyone who's interested. You mentioned you and your wife argue. I kind of caught a few of the references to that in the book. Like there was one time where you said, I learned to deal and stay calm when my daughter had tantrums because I practiced being calm with my wife. I think you even said that you and your wife do postmortems on your arguments.
Yeah.
What do you do? Why are you doing all this?
Yeah, my wife and I, it's not so much. We've gone through, you know, years of phases where we argued a lot in our relationship.
What's an argument that you two would have? Can you be open about that?
Yeah, I mean, we argue about the normal things, sex, money, you know, all the normal stuff that people argue about.
Sex isn't not enough, or sex isn't not what I like.
Well, when we got together, my wife and I met at Burning Man. We met at the Burning Man Festival. And, you know, I was a dating guru in a past life. And I had gone through relationships, like kind of my life before my wife was, I would have a girlfriend for a year or two, have a great relationship, and then be single for maybe a year or two and date a bunch of people and then have a relationship and then date a bunch of people. And I was in my late 30s. I had just gotten to the point where I finally was accepting that I wasn't going to find someone that was a partner for me. And so I also got to the point where I realized when I'm dating different people, I don't really like this hiding. It's not like I would lie, but I just wouldn't talk about the other people I was dating usually. That was kind of uncomfortable and whatever. And so I just said, okay, if I'm going to be single for the rest of my life, if that's just kind of my lot in life, I want to be able to be more open and more honest. And it was strange, the timing of all of this, but I was just getting to this point where I was like accepting, all right, this is going to be me forever. And so when I met my wife, I was very open about this. I thought I was going to date, you know, different people. And she seemed okay with this. A lot of our friends in California and things had open relationships. And so when we got together, this was like a pretense that we had, is we were going to have a kind of an open relationship. But then we just fought over that a lot over time. So
because, you know, one of you was with someone else and then it created jealousy. I'm trying to think of the word jealousy and envy because you define them separately.
Yeah, a little bit of that. I mean, we experimented a little bit in the beginning, but mostly it was fighting because we weren't doing that. But like I was upset because I thought we're going to date a bunch of different people. And so, you know, I would get upset and then we would, you know, go back and forth. It was more just fighting over the principle than anything else.
You know what? So you had this line in the book. I didn't copy it because I didn't think I could even find a way to fit it into this interview. But you basically said most people aren't in touch with their emotions because once they finish experience, first of all, they want to get out of the experience of feeling it. And then second, once they're done, they've moved on. They don't want to come back to that pain. Yeah. And I thought about that. When my wife and I argue about something, I am so frustrated with the argument that this is not what I signed up for, not to argue. And I don't want to go back to us being angry at each other and the tension. So we just kind of leave it alone and walk away. You will sit down with your wife and you'll have a conversation about this, about here's how we argued, how do we do it better? I feel like this somehow connects to what you were saying about mental models. And so I'm trying to understand that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. we could go off the rails on this one. We could go pretty far.
I won't let us. It would be okay.
Okay. No, I mean in the positive sense. I mean, we could go deep here.
Okay.
So my wife and I, we take this relationship, this true love partnership thing, this collaborative partnership thing very, very seriously. And if there's something that's creating friction or tension, we don't give it up. We don't stop. We would rather keep talking about it and fighting over it and getting upset until we get to the core, to the heart of the thing, and we figure out what it is and we solve it. And the, you know, depending on what your background is or like how sensitive you are, this can create a lot of tension and a lot of friction. And, you know, you got to be in for the long
game. Because it'll
go
on for multiple days or because it'll go on all night?
Oh, it can go on for multiple years.
Oh, you'll have this one argument that you just keep talking over.
Well, I mean, that's what everybody's having already. Everybody's having the same argument over and over and over. I would just say that we have them a little more intentionally, I think.
Okay, so I'm fascinated by mental models. It feels like then what you have is some mental model seems like almost a written down system. You give an example about how Charlie Munger will take his, he says that you have to invest through mental models and then he'll take them and turn them into checklists. You say that in the book Opportunity.
Sure.
But I'm fascinated by whether you two, she's a relationship counselor, isn't she?
Yeah, she's a love coach.
A love coach. This is Annie. She, will you write things down based on that? Will you say, because my wife and I will have some mental models around this, like, any serious conversation that happens after 9 p.m., Andrew's just going to be too stressed to deal with it well, and he's going to shut it down. So the other night, she was going to bring something up. I said, baby, if we talk about it now, you know it's going to be tense, and I'm going to argue with it because I'm not in the right frame of mind. I just want to relax. So that's like one mental model, not fully written down, but it helps our relationship tremendously.
Sure.
Do you guys do that, and is it more formal than that?
Well, can I introduce mental models for a second?
Yeah.
Okay. So mental models are basically being able to run a simulation of some kind in your mind so that you don't have to do trial and error out in the world. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are just doing trial and error. If you've got a little machine that you can use in your mind to simulate how the thing works, right, you can then make better predictions. You can have better guesses about things, right? So we all know the Pareto principle, 80-20 rule, mm-hmm. right? 80% of the results come from 20% of the work, 20% of the inputs. For a mental model, you could imagine like a circle and then within it, another circle that's maybe 20% the size of that other circle. And if you go and look at any domain in life, instead of looking at the whole thing, ask, what's the 20% of this domain that's actually giving me all of the results? If you're looking at what you eat every day, just imagine looking at all of it in a circle. What's the 20% that gives you the most nutrients and the most energy? You know, if you're in your relationships, let's say that you've got a bunch of relationships in your life and you're feeling friction from some of them. If you just look, what's the 20% of your relationships that are giving you 80% of your friction? Mm-hmm. It's right. This is there. So that's a mental model. That's an example. My wife and I, when it comes to using mental models, we have several that we use for our relationship. One of them is collaboration. So collaboration is when two people that are very different, but that have complementary skills learn about each other and they learn to synchronize and combine their powers. And they learn to understand that each of you has a different model of reality, a different lens on reality, different paradigm, different values set. And that the conflict is often because you value different things. But when you can learn to appreciate the other person's values and they can learn to appreciate yours, even if it triggers them, even if it's upsetting, even if it's activating, that when you synchronize those two things and you collaborate, you put them together, you're going to get a result that's much better than either of you could have gotten alone.
So, okay, I think I've got – I'm going to bring it down to something really tactical, but tell me if this shows that I've got an understanding of what you're talking about. Olivia loves to have her back scratch at 10 o'clock at night. I'm like reading a book. I'm zoned out, maybe even watching Netflix. If I understand, it doesn't give me any – it doesn't nurture me to do it, but it also doesn't hurt that much. And just like reach over and scratch her back while I'm watching Halt and Catch Fire on Netflix, then I know I'm making her happy even if it doesn't necessarily mean much to me. Is that what you're talking about?
No, that would be a compromise, I would say, or where maybe you're making a sacrifice.
Okay.
What I would ask you to imagine is she likes to have her back scratched at 10 o'clock and you like to watch Netflix. If you two will sit down and talk about this and ask, what is something that we could create that's better than you watching Netflix and her getting her back scratched at 10 o'clock? And you keep working on it until you find something. There might be some third thing that neither of you have considered. Right? Where maybe, you know, maybe at 8 o'clock, she would rather have her feet rubbed and you have a foot fetish, but you know, you guys have never really talked about that.
And I have more energy at 8 o'clock. Right. So now we're accommodating me and accommodating her. The part that, if you saw my eyes do this blink, it's because I was going, oh my God, you have to talk about it a lot, but you do. That's what it is.
You have to talk about it a lot. And you have to deal with your triggers a lot and you have to deal with them. And learning, you know, in attachment theory, they talk about self-regulation. And self-regulation, it's the new emotional maturity. being able to regulate your own emotions. Do you have kids?
I do.
Okay. So you know that when the children show up, this is a whole other thing, because they are like tailor designed to put the mom and dad out of emotional whack so they can get what they want from the situation. They're you know, these little geniuses at this. And so learning self-regulation is critical, because once you get into a family system or a business system where there's multiple people and all these games happen,
yes,
it's the only way to stay sane, really.
I know now you have partners. I think at some point in the book, Opportunity, you said, I won't go into business without a partner on something. Do you do the same thing with your partner? Do you understand your partner's do you understand what makes them tick well enough to find this? Do you talk endlessly with them, or is this just a husband-wife thing?
No, I really try to take on, and I've been doing it a lot more the last couple of years, I really try to take on being a great partner and a great mentor to my partners, and appreciating what makes them, like what their unique talents are, and letting them grow and, you know, become all that they can be. And I try the best I can to put that ahead of even the financial rewards and results. I really, in my life, I try to make it so that the people that I'm working with or the people that I'm partnered with are learning and growing most, and they're becoming all they can be. And then secondarily, you know, we're successful.
I wonder what your process is for that. One of the ones that stuck out for me was Cameron Harold. I read his book, Double Double, after getting to know him. And he says that what he'll do is he'll ask his people, not just to help him visualize where the company goes, but to say, let's make a list of all the things that you want for your life. Now, he's helping them identify their bucket list, their dream list, their goal list, but it's also helping him understand what they want out of life so that he can help them get it through the job that they have or in general, and that connects them better to his work. That's a process that he's developed. Do you have a process that you do with your partners that we can bring in here?
Well, I do that for sure.
You'll sit down with them and say, what is it that you want to get out of life? What is it that you want out of this business?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, even more than that. So when I now work with someone, whether I invest in them or I'm partnered with them, I always tell them my wife comes along as part of the deal, and she is going to work with you on your life, on your romance, on your friendships, on your family, on all of your relationships in your life. And you're likely to get more value from her than you get from me. And of course, that, you know, people usually laugh at that because they don't know, but then it turns out being true. And so, you know, I take very seriously that my partners and the people that I'm close to need to have successful personal lives. And so I look and I ask them questions about what their values are and what their struggles are and what their challenges are with their family. And I cross all of those lines to help people have more fulfilling and more healthy and, you know, more purpose-driven lives.
All right. Let me take a moment to talk about my sponsor. It's a company called TopTal. Do you know TopTal?
No, I don't.
Okay, I'm about to introduce them to you in less than 60 seconds. Here's the deal. Look at how Eben and I are talking so much about relationships. Look at how I'm writing down. I have a list of things that my wife is excited about so that I'm aware of it. You're drawing out the people you work with, and you're bringing your wife in to help her to help them through her have better personal lives. Because we think about this stuff. This is what we obsess with. And then what do many entrepreneurs do who think this way too? They say, I need a developer. I better go on the cheapest freelancing website that I can to get someone who's going to do exactly what I tell them to do. And the problem with that is that, number one, you're not telling other people you care about and work what to do, because you know that if you nourish them, if you understand them, if they're leaders, they could direct better than you can, number one. And number two, you know that what you want is people who think about this stuff, even if they're in their off time. Eben does not have to say, it's 9 to 5, I better sit in, or someone's on the clock, I have to sit and think about relationships and write this down. He didn't say, I've got to write this book because someone told me exactly what to type out. You do it because you care about it. Same thing is what we should be looking for in top developers. These are people who we can care about, and more importantly, they care about the problem. They will sit with it over the weekend. They will sit with it before going to sleep. They will dream about it, and they will care about your problem until it's solved in a creative way that you could never imagine. If you want to hire the best of the best developers, I'm going to urge you to go and do this one thing. Not even go and hire from TopTal, but go and have a conversation with one of their matchers. Once you do, you tell them, here are my dreams. Here's what I need out of this person. Here's how we work. If they can't match it, they'll tell you. And frankly, the majority of complaints that I get about sponsors are people who say, I went to TopTal like you told me, and they turned me away. Well, good. Congratulations. That means it's not a good match. You're not wasting your money. So, and if you can, if they can match you, they often will get you set up with a great developer who can start within a couple of days. All right, go to this URL where you're going to get 80 hours of top Tal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Have been somewhere in the back of your head, this is going to get lodged in. One of the companies you invest in hopefully will need someone, and you'll love them. It's top Tal. Top is in top of your head. Tal is in talent. TOPTAL.com/MixerG. I'm grateful to them. I was actually spitting up with excitement out of that. I also am thinking I should speed up my ads.
I got a good idea for you about the relationship stuff. A little, it's a technique. It's kind of a model that we have, and it's a technique.
I love it.
If you're finding in your relationship that you have sensitive issues, right? These kind of vortex issues that pull you into conflict, and you really want to talk to your partner about it, but you know that it's going to, you know, be explosive. What you can do is you can go to your partner and give your partner a note that you've written to your future self in a moment when you're getting triggered and activated, that where you write to yourself what you need to hear to calm yourself down.
Yeah.
So,
that's good.
Right? Your partner's trying to talk to you about something, but you're getting triggered and activated. And then they hand you this note and it comes to you and it says, Eben, but it was written by me.
Right.
And it says, Eben, you know, take a breath right now, close your eyes, calm down, regulate yourself. You know, if you have to, take a break, but, you know, calm down right now. And then you give it to your partner and you say, here, I'm going to give you this note. If you give this to me at any point in any situation in the future, I will stop. I'll back off. I will regulate myself and I'll come back to you when I've regulated and we can continue the conversation. It can create a little safe space between you and your partner where they can then feel safe to talk through an issue. And then you'll know that if they give it to you, you have to calm down. You can give them that
is
one.
Is it wrong that I was hoping you were going to say, go and sleep with other women? We found the research shows this is the answer. Olivia will not let me sleep with other women.
Yeah, that's probably not the answer for most people. Yeah.
All right. I thought maybe you had research that backed it up. Speaking of regulate, you have in your book this line that I wrote, most adults don't have parents who are able to regulate their own nervous systems. I know mine didn't have this skill. And then you went on to say about how your dad was violent. Can you talk a little bit about your parents and what was going on in there? I was trying to read between the lines, but now that I've got you here, tell me.
Yeah, you know, I've got, you know, Italian parents that grew up in Brooklyn, New York. You know, my dad basically on the street, I think he dropped out of school in second or third grade, you know, and like he sold drugs when he was growing up and like he kind of had a rough background. And he and my mother, they moved out to Oregon because they were hippies, you know, they wanted me to grow up off the grid and they heard Oregon was a good place for it. And I'm grateful that they did it, but you know, it was stressful for them and he couldn't really cope with regular society. And he was violent with us.
For example, what was it that would set him off?
Oh, it, you know, random things. It was just random things. Sometimes he'd be upset because he didn't get his government assistance check or, you know, because my mom didn't make food that he liked or, you know, something was stressing him out.
And then he would hit you.
Yeah.
How?
You know, spanking, belts, sometimes he'd pick up a piece of wood and, you know, hit me with it, that kind of thing.
And then did you make any decisions about your life after one of those situations? Like, I'm never going to do this. Did you decide what you wanted?
Well, you know, two things. When I was maybe, I don't know, probably 20, 21, he had to move and he got really stressed and he got really angry and kind of behaved violently toward me. And it put 10 or 15 years between us where we really didn't talk that much. And so, you know, there was a part of me where I pulled away at that point. Later in my life, when my wife and I got together and when she and I early on in a relationship, we would get into fights about things. And a couple of times we would be fighting and she'd just like reach up and slap my face. And I would just say, you know, we don't want to do that. You know, I know where that goes. You know, I come from a place.
Yeah.
And so I really stood for not having that in our relationship. And, it's only been the last several years, like maybe, you know, 4 or 5 years, my dad passed away right before my daughter was born. So this is about, you know, just over 5 years ago now. And, I've gotten to the point where I have appreciation. I actually have gratitude for what I experienced as a child because I know where that goes. Like
you say, lucky even. How can you say lucky that having a dad who did this to you, was a lucky break?
Well, one of the things that I believe is that you can take a wound or a problem. And if you have the right attitude toward it, you can turn it into something better than what you would have had had you not had it. And so, as I mentioned, if you have a fight with your partner, if you believe that that can make the relationship stronger, you know, like working out a muscle, then you can come back and work it out and make the relationship stronger. And what I try to do in my life is to systematically go back through and find every break that I've had as much as I can. There are a couple, you know, that haven't been able to fix yet, but I'm working on it. And when you go back and you fix them and you work through it, and from a more mature place, you see where the other person was coming from. They understand where you were coming from. Maybe you've both grown up. When the relationship heals, you take a priceless lesson away from it, you know? And I am so fortunate, you know, in the big scheme of things in my life to have seen what I've seen and to have experienced what I experienced. And while it's not like I would want this for other people. It's all a blessing. It was all a blessing for me.
But it's made you a better father because you saw the way that he fathered you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There are things that I've just said to my wife, like there are things that I just won't do, you know, I won't do. I mean, even sometimes with my little daughter, you know, we don't spank her. We try to be really careful to not spank her, not shame her, not raise our voice at her, to really treat her as with equal dignity as a being, as a collaborative participant in our family. But sometimes we get triggered and we get upset with her. And, you know, when she was a little younger, there were a few times where she would be doing something and I would kind of roughly like grab her and pick her up and then bring her into another room to do something. And I'm very sensitive to when I have that kind of violent energy, whether it's in my tone or my actions or the way I'm physically touching her. And when it's over, you know, I come back to my wife and either I or my wife, but it's usually more me, will say, you know, it's just not acceptable for me to have any of that type of energy with my child. And if I hadn't had these experiences, I wouldn't understand how deeply it impacts a person.
You're very regulated in your conversation. Do you feel like that seeing your dad be unable to regulate his nervous system made you overregulate or hyperregulate, over adds some kind of judgment on it? No.
I mean, that's just who you could are. Be. I went through a phase where I probably went through like 10 years of my life where the expression of any negative emotion, I was into Wayne Dyer when I was younger, and I kind of got this trip from him, like, you know, just like everything's good and just always kind of be positive. I would express it. I mean, it's, I don't know.
You just got into it. And you say this again in your book. You say, look, I forget where it is. You have to practice, you have to build a lucky self-image. You have to practice seeing yourself as a lucky person. I imagine somebody who's listening to us or reading your book, Opportunity, reading that saying, dude, my business is on the verge of collapsing. I'm not looking at this as lucky. This is just such a hyper-rational, overly nicey-nice way of looking at the world. How do I even do that? And why should I even try when really the reality of the world is it's really tough right now? What's the benefit of doing it?
To just finish my thread there, I probably went through 10 years where I was like Mr. like everything's great no matter what. Mm-hmm. But for the last probably 10 years, I appear this way, but my wife and I have arguments regularly. We have arguments in front of other people.
You raise your voice in front of other people?
I wouldn't. I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes we have, if we're really passionate about it and we've got friends around that, you know, we're close to and we think we can handle it. I don't know. I want to live an authentic life, you know, and I've got a daughter, you know, we get upset around our house once in a while. It's not a lot, but, you know, I mean, God, every few days somebody gets upset about something, you know, and gets triggered. And so, yeah, when I say regulate, I don't mean artificially. I mean that when you do get upset, to remember, oh, the inner chimp came out and grabbed me and took over and like, okay, I'm triggered. And the lizard brain's, okay, take some breaths, just breathe. I mean, I'm 47 years old right now, and it's only been in the last year where all this stuff has really caught on, where I've learned – wherever it is, if I wake up in the middle of the night and I've had a bad dream, if something's going weird in my business and I'm worried about cash flow, if something's happening with my wife, if I've gotten triggered by my mom, that all of them are part of one kind of unified thing called I got triggered, and just breathe. and just stop what I'm doing and just breathe. And then when I'm back, then re-engage. Because if I don't, whatever I do when I'm triggered is not something I'm going to look back on in the future and be proud of.
Okay, so that's part of your process. How do you identify this process, and what happens next for you in that process? How do you know the breathing for you works? For someone else, it might be go for a walk. For someone else, it might be something else. How do you identify that?
Well, you know, to me, one of the things I learned about this might have, I can't remember where I got this from. It might have been some Werner Erhard influence. But the idea is called complete emotion cycles. Emotions come in waves, and they flood our bodies with chemicals, and then they kind of go away. And it takes several minutes for an emotion cycle, kind of a standard emotion cycle, to happen. For some of us, if you get really triggered, for me, I'll feel them for, you know, hours, sometimes for days. I kind of can't get rid of a feeling if, like, we're in a really, you know, big fight or something really, you know, hard happens. But what a lot of us do, and I definitely did this when I was younger, is we don't feel them. We don't allow them into our consciousness. We think, okay, I'm just going to push that down. I'm going to distract myself. I'm going to do the next thing. But when we do that, they get kind of pent up, and then we kind of can't have emotional experiences that are flowing with other people and with ourselves. And so the key practice is, it's not walking or breathing. It's to feel the emotions that you're feeling. So when the emotion comes up and you feel triggered, to stop and to feel where the emotion is. Feel, for a lot of people, anger might be, you know, up the back of the neck, in the head, or in the chest, or in the arms, or sadness might be, you know, in the chest or the stomach, or anxiety might be, you know, high in the chest. You feel it, and you presently stay with it as it moves through your system, and allow yourself to have a complete emotion cycle. Don't interrupt them. And even though it's hard to do, when it's over a few minutes later, and you've just felt it and stayed with it, when it goes, then it really goes, and it doesn't keep coming back to haunt you the way that it does.
If it's not finished, it's going to keep coming back at you until it's finished. All right, so let me bring this back to something practical that I'm experiencing in business. We've built a part of our business on Facebook chatbot platform. You know, anytime you work with Facebook, that there's a risk they're going to turn their backs on you. You know that there's a platform risk anytime you identify one platform as your main source of anything. And suddenly they said, you know what? We've got the security issue. We want to analyze all new chatbots before we allow any more on our platform. Completely rational, considering what's going on. But there's a part of me that woke up in the middle of the night going, why are you not more scared of this? This is actually a big part of your business. It's an exciting part of your business. It's now stumped. It's now stalled because of this. And frankly, who knows what could happen? I then said, I'm going to play BoJack Horseman in my earbud to go back to sleep. And sure enough, I hit BoJack Horseman. It's a stupid cartoon on Netflix. My mind paid attention to the story for all of 1 minute, stopped feeling the pain, went to sleep. And then in the morning, I had some idea of what we do next, but I don't know that I fully experienced that feeling. And I don't know that I fully have the right answer based on it. I'm now going through this. What would you say I should do in that to experience the feeling and then to create a model for situations like this when they happen inevitably again?
Yeah, well, there are two levels, two good reasons to feel the feeling, you know, to maybe just take a few minutes. Maybe for you, it's go for a walk or go somewhere where you feel safe. You may need to be around your family or at home, but go somewhere, if you're going to feel fear, where you feel safe, and then go back and revisit the emotion and feel it come through your body. Notice where it is as it's moving through your body. If it's fear, just say fear. And you can say it out loud even, because the key is activating mind and emotions in sync with each other. Most people cannot name the emotion that they're feeling while they're feeling it. Most people just can't do that because they're not even aware consciously of what emotion they're feeling while they're feeling it. There's a taboo, kind of. And so you just say fear, and then you feel it. Fear, you feel it, allow it to come, allow it to go. Something really, for me in particular, happens magically at the end of the emotion cycle. When you're coming back out of it, if you're triggered, when you're coming back out of the trigger, if you feel fear, when you're coming back out of the fear, when you're coming back into your normal state, you can look back and you can see what happened and what triggered you. And you can also see how you got into that situation in the first place. I call it the bridge of insight. It's like being able to walk out onto a bridge and then look back and see what happened with more clarity. And in that moment, you'll usually get a great insight about how you got yourself into it, or how you set yourself up for it, or how maybe this is an early childhood thing that got triggered again.
So you're saying, do spend the time later in the day going back and saying, you identified fear, what triggered it, what are you afraid of, why is that, and spend some time on that thought.
Yeah, stay with it. Stay with feeling it. This is courage. This is some of the strongest kind of courage. It takes more courage to do this for a lot of people than to, you know, go into battle.
So it occurred to me, we've got an audience of entrepreneurs. This book is written, I feel, for a lot of different people, but maybe it's because I'm an entrepreneur. I picked up on the business part of this. How does all this relate to business? Isn't this just the touchy-feely side of business or the touchy-feely part of being human that the strong business people don't have to go through? I don't imagine Elon Musk today sleeping in a sleeping bag on the factory floor trying to get the Model 3 out saying, what am I feeling internally? Is it that we're weak? Is it that we're getting ourselves distracted to care about this when what I should be asking you is, how did you double your sales? How did you create your first video? How did you get, you know, how does this all this touchy-feely stuff relate to business? Not to put it down as touchy-feely, but you know.
Well, I don't, so we're down the rabbit hole of emotions and relationships and conflict and wounds and, you know, that's what we're talking about. If we go talk about business, I would love to talk about things you could double your business or how to get more leads and all that stuff. I mean, that's what I teach, you know, in all my business courses. I don't necessarily see them as being, you know, in conflict with each other. I mean, Elon Musk, for example, I don't know if you read the Rolling Stone article, but I don't know. I mean, emotionally, he's having a really hard time. You know, he's lonely and, you know, depressed over a lot of this stuff and frustrated and, you know, read about some of the stuff with his dad. And I mean, I have endless admiration for Elon Musk, but also my heart goes out for him because it sounds like he hasn't really allocated enough time and energy and attention to work on the emotional side of his life. And, you know, probably for him, if he'd put 10 or 20% into this, you know, he might get to Mars like, you know, a year later or something, but when he gets there, he'll be a better role model, I think, for everyone. He'll be happier and more proud of the way that he did it.
Do you feel that this inner game of, I was going to say inner game of entrepreneur, but the inner game of human, of being human, did this help you build up your business? How?
Yeah, it really did, because as I've worked on my own inner game stuff, I mean, the real inner game work started when I was working on the dating, because I was, you know, in mortal fear to go talk to a woman, and I had to overcome that and figure out how to, you know, develop courage. And then as I was in business, you know, and building my business, I realized, oh, wow, this stuff just translates over. Like Stephen Covey says, you know, every public victory is preceded by a private victory. And it's a powerful idea right now that, you know, we're these creative beings. And if we don't have inner integrity, it's hard to be effective out in the world. And as I did, I also encouraged my team and all the people that I worked with. And I've done lots of different things with my teams over the years to try to transmit to them what I'm learning and share with them and have a culture of honesty and of trust. And I'm not perfect about it, but I found that having a place where it's safe to be who you are and to say whatever's on your mind and to be authentic, I've passed up making a lot of money because I haven't just been, you know, all about the bottom line and like just business. And sometimes I'll do things to, you know, support someone on the team that's going through something hard. But in the long run, when you look back on your life, I think that having a more integrated life where you're more developed in different places, it just works better. You build more esteem. You become more self-actualized. You're a better role model. You feel better about yourself. You evolve more.
You know what? As I say this, I've now been living in San Francisco, so I've gotten to know entrepreneurs here really well. And in private, they do have conversations about this stuff now that I think about it. And it may not be with every single person, but when I draw them out on it, they will say things like there's one guy, he's got an Apple Watch app that he created for himself to be aware of. He's incredibly successful. People wouldn't even realize that he thinks about this stuff. His mental highs and lows, it feels like he's a very even keeled person, but he's very aware of his inner depths and his inner highs and how he has to recognize when he goes up and down so that he can be more even keeled and think more clearly through difficulties. I've heard so many interesting things. Drugs are a big part of it, like exploring with drugs, frankly, people talk about as a way of getting to know themselves. And then Oh, and then because it's San Francisco too, you hear weird things. Like one guy went to a strip club. He said, I want to understand how female attention affects my ability to be creative. And so he went to a strip club with someone to work and watch himself how he worked with the female attention on him. So all that's to say, not that this is what you're advocating, but that I imagine no entrepreneur cares about this, but the reality that I'm experiencing disagrees with it. They do care about this. They do think about this endlessly. All right. So I'm going to come back after the sponsorship break. And then what do we have? Do you have a little extra time to go a little longer with me?
Sure.
Okay. We'll come back and talk about the book Opportunity. My second sponsor is a company called HostGator. Real quick, guys, if you're looking for somebody to host your website, right, you've got tons of different companies that can do it for you. Frankly, just go search it and you'll see on Google how many different options you have. So with all those options, why should you go with HostGator? Why did I go with HostGator? Simple reason. They've been around for years. They've been doing this since the very beginning. How many entrepreneurs did I interview here who got into hosting, got clobbered, ended up having to sell their businesses? They did okay for themselves, but basically they sold their businesses because the hosting space was too tough to compete in. And who did they say clobbered them? HostGator. HostGator is out there buying competitors, building themselves up, and today they're one of the majors out there. Hosting now is a service that you can get from the best for an easy to digest price. I'm looking at their website now, the one I'm about to give you in a moment. For $2.64 a month, you can have your website hosted. Whatever your idea is, bring it to HostGator. And if you already have a website and you don't like your hosting company, switch to HostGator. We've been very happy with them. I put Bot Academy on them at the cheap plan. Then we upgraded and upgraded. The more we needed, the more they told us it's not on our website, but we got your back. We'll upgrade with you, and always for a lower price than their competitors. Go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. Sign up right now and you will get unmetered. You know what? The whole list of things is right on their site. Go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. All right. Let's come back to one of the business ideas in the book. You say, we need to start with version 1 and then go for version 3.0. Start with the minimum viable product. The business that I knew you for was info products, selling things like videos online. You started out, though, with a seminar to 23 people, and you recorded what? Can you tell me that experience and how that teaches us start small and build to version 3?
Yeah. So I wrote a book of dating advice. I took 3 weeks to write that book. I put it online. It took off. People really liked it. It became successful.
I'm sorry to interrupt. How do you write a book in three weeks? How do you get yourself from blank page to something that is useful and then build your career?
Yeah. Well, the first way is when you go learn something, to learn it like it matters. Learn it like it's going to be something in the future. And so I always keep a journal. At that time, I used to keep written journals. And whenever I would learn something about dating, I would write it in my journals. And so I had a lot of material that I had learned from different places. And so I could just go back to my notes and start there. And then the other thing you do to write a book in 3 weeks is make sure it's not very long. So many people come to me and they talk about the difference that the book has made. Maybe a month or two ago, I opened it back up. It's been years since I read it. I read the whole thing. The original was like 92 pages or something. And I don't even think like full sized pages. And so, you know, make it not very long and you can do it. You know, you can knock something out.
Okay. So you wrote the book and then
it took off and I'd been around the information marketing industry a little bit. I'd worked with, you know, I mentioned Joe Stump and so forth. And so I knew that the next phase was that I would need to do a seminar or create an audio and video product. And so I announced that I was doing a seminar online, and I had 23 people that paid to come to the seminar. I got a little conference room in a hotel, and we borrowed a video camera, and I had one of my guys stand in the back of the room with one. It was a one camera shoot. So if you see that original course, it's just like one camera. And then my other friend ran the audio for it, and we recorded it. And then I took the audio and we released an audio course. And back then, video was, you know, who knew how to do that? It took us 9 months. We had to go rent a Mac and Final Cut and figure out how to make DVDs and all that. It took 9 months to get the video course done. And then we launched that. And then I did that seminar a few more times. I did one in New York, and I did one in Chicago, and I did one in Australia. And I just kind of kept trying to tweak and refine it. And then we came back, and because that course was my best-selling course, my best-selling audio and video course, I said, okay, I need to make a version that I'm proud of. And so then we did another video shoot, and I had a bunch of great teachers come, and we made one that now we've you know, we've been selling for probably close to 15 years or something like that, and people still buy it and still use it and love it.
What is it about the number three, the version three, that's magical? Or did I just pick up on one little item in the book and give it too much power?
I mean, the reason why I like version three is because you can usually do pretty well by version two. Version two can be pretty good. But most people, when they're starting a business, if they don't have any entrepreneurial experience, they'll waste a year or two trying to design the perfect product, and they won't even be interacting with any customers and asking, like, what do you think of it? And then by the time when they launch it and then nobody's interested, they just become, you know, crestfallen and depressed and, you know, horrified by the whole thing. And so what I'm really trying to get across is get something in the hands of customers as fast as you possibly can, and then get that second one done. Because when you start designing with real feedback from real human beings, and you're kind of doing like a prosumer effect, it's very, you know, it's super enlightening. You're learning a new way of doing things. So if you start saying, I'm going to get to version three as fast as I can, it makes you do version one and two, you know, much faster. A lot of that is for, you know, newer folks. I mean, really, you want to just keep going. You want to keep iterating and making your products better and better and better. But 3.0, it gets you to 1.0 and 2.0 much quicker.
I don't know if you remember, but we talked a few years ago, and one of the things that you said to me is, Andrew, when you want to teach something, do an online webinar about it, sell tickets to that. I'm wondering why that's the approach that you found that works.
Uh-huh. Well, I teach a lot of courses on information products and digital products and courses. And like I said about products there, a lot of times people will spend a year or 2 or 3 years of their life trying to make the perfect audio course or like the perfect book or design the perfect seminar, instead of just getting out and teaching some of their material and seeing what people think and seeing the questions that they ask. Much better if you want to create a course or a digital product or teach or do a podcast, much better to just email all your friends or email your list or, you know, post something to your social and say, on Friday, I'm doing this thing. Or even better, tonight, I am doing this thing. I'm going to get on and I'm going to share these 3 points about how to do this thing. And then I'm going to do question and answer. Jump on with me. You can even do it right now. You can just jump right on like Facebook Live these days and say, everyone, I've been procrastinating. I need to, you know, teach, you know, how to get your parrot to talk or whatever. I've been working with my parrot for years. I've got some great techniques. I got 3 ways you can get your parrot saying anything and whatever. I'm going on in 10 minutes. Just jump on with me right now. Get out there and, you know, get broadcasting and get into it. This is the esteem you'll build, the interaction you'll get, the
And do it free, or is that the first thing you sell?
You can do it either way. I think you should do it for free.
Do it for free.
If you even want it. Yeah, if you want to go even upstream from that, offer some coaching sessions.
Why
this
coaching?
Is really the best way.
You said that in the book Opportunity too. Why?
Yeah. Well, I think coaching is one of the skills of the future. I taught a course on it last year. We created a big program about it. I've been doing it for many years and studying it for a lot of years. But it really occurred to me, you know, 2-3 years ago, what a coach does, I define coaching as supporting another person through a transition. That's what a coach does. They support another person as they go through an important transition or transformation in their life. All of us now have less time. We have less friends. We have more social media, more, you know, YouTube, more distractions coming. But we're also going through more transitions because we've got more interests and we've got things going in our personal life and our business life and we're moving and we're, you know, we've got all these things happening, but we don't have the friendship that supports us. And a coach in a certain way is a professional friend. They understand the skills of being a great listener, of facilitating you as you figure out a solution, of holding you accountable, making sure that you do things without kind of you having to reciprocate. The way you reciprocate is you get paid to do it. When you learn coaching, you learn to be a professional friend. You learn to listen professionally. You learn how to get down to the point of what another person is trying to do, what their values are, what their outcomes are.
Shouldn't you be an expert before you coach other people about how to do the thing that you're teaching them?
No. Coaching itself is a whole universe, and you don't need to be an expert on anything in order to become a really great coach. And in fact, if you're an expert in some ways, I mean, it can be wonderful, but in some ways it gets in the way because what you're always trying to do is tell the person what to do rather than letting them figure it out. A coach is like a parent, right? When you're a parent, you don't tell your child what to do all the time and do it for them because then they're going to grow up thinking you're the one that they need to go to so that you can do it for them, right? A successful parent has a child that says, I did it. You know, so the child goes, look, I did it, Dad. That's when you're a successful parent. It's the same thing with a coaching client. When they do it, then you've won. Then you've really succeeded. And there are skills where you can learn to do that.
All right. Here's another thing again.
One more thing. Yeah, I just got to say this about coaching. So my insight was, as I looked around at personal relationships, business relationships, family relationships, friendships, it just occurred to me that we don't know how to have high quality relationships. We didn't get that training. And coaching teaches you that thing. It teaches you how to be an amazing supporter of other people, an amazing facilitator, a great friend. And it's a cornerstone skill. Everything that we do in the future is going to come back to in some way be enhanced or made better by coaching. And whether you do it with us or you go to somewhere else or you read a book, definitely learn coaching. It is one of the cornerstone skills of the future.
You gave me this course. I actually pulled my phone out so I could get the name of the course. This was again on our call and you were generous with that. And one of the things that stood out for me was it was a live session that you did and it was shot well. And you also did interviews. And in the interviews, one thing that you did that I don't do, it may just not be my style, but you stopped in the conversation, turned over to the audience, and you said, here's what we just learned here. And as an interviewer, there's always this sense of I am the student learning from the master. You should almost, it almost makes the person feel inferior to keep asking questions or less than someone who you'd want to turn to as a coach because he's asking so many questions. What you did that was really smart was you turn around and say, I'm actually the teacher here with you. I brought them on, this person on as the expert, and I'm going to translate for you because I am the teacher. And I'm also going to provide a service in this conversation because you might lose the points. I felt like that was a really, I don't know why I brought this up, but it just kind of stood out in my head as I was looking at my interview style versus yours.
Well, one of the things that that I've realized is that most communication is miscommunication. Most things that people say and do are misunderstood. They're misinterpreted by other people. And we don't realize that this is happening. Okay. So if you say something to another person one way, okay, if I say to you like, hey, here's how to make this chicken dish or something, you're probably about 80% likely to misunderstand that, get some part of it wrong. But if I say it in two different ways, maybe I show you a picture of it and I, you know, show you a little video, then I send you a recipe, it moves from 80% down to maybe only 30%. And if I do three different ways, like I send you a picture, I send you the recipe, and then maybe I show you how to do it, now there's a very small probability that there's going to be a misunderstanding. And I've just learned most people won't raise their hand and say, I don't understand what you just said. Because they get enough of it where they go, you know what, I don't want to interrupt the flow, you know, so let me not mess with it. But I've learned most people are not understanding things. And so if you go slower and you say the thing in a bunch of different ways, then everyone will appreciate it a lot more because they'll say, okay, now I really understand it.
You talked about that too. There's a lot that still sticks in my head, but for some reason, I know why I can't get the name of the course because I moved from one Google Drive to another. And maybe you can remind me, what was the name of that course about how to create courses?
You know, it's probably the Digital Product Blueprint.
Maybe that's it. That is the one. The word blueprint stuck out in my head. I just went to Napa and I sat down and I watched it. I find that I do my best work when I'm away from the office, going through a program, taking notes, and ideally in Napa where it's sunny. There are a couple of things that stood out for me. One other one was people have different ways of learning. Some are doers, some are listeners, etc. And that explained to me why there's so many books where at the end of each chapter, they'd have a section of questions. And I go, I never do this. Who does the list of questions at the end of a chapter? And I realize there's some people like my wife who do it. That's the way that they learn. And then the other thing was when you want to teach, don't just teach this ephemeral thing. Teach something that they could create that's visible in the world. And you definitely have a better way of explaining that. But the tangible is really interesting as opposed to people stood up at your program, said, here's what I want to teach. I want to teach people how to be happier. And you say, well, what's the thing that's going to make them happier? Does that sum it up well?
Yeah.
Not super well.
Communication. Well, it's, you know, again, big rabbit hole here. We could talk about this all day.
Let me continue with this. The leading fringe. I'll finish up with this. I asked Chance, what's Chance's name? He's the guy who taught relationships for women, kind of partnered up with you.
Chance Barnett. Chance
Barnett. Yeah, it's been a while since I've gotten to talk to him. And I asked him, what is it about this guy? What is it about Eben Pagan that you're partnering up with him that you admire. He said, I've never seen anyone take ideas and implement them so well. I said, like what? He goes, well, this whole digital online marketing stuff. And at the time, I immediately closed my mind to it because I said, this was 10 years ago or so. I said, online marketers, they're a scummy group of people. I can't pay attention to them. I admire just software people. And he explained it to me, and I was oblivious to it because I closed my mind to it. But as I've looked at you over the years, you've done that. Who are the leading fringe? What are we looking for in these subcultures, and why? And how has that helped you become a better entrepreneur?
Yeah. So I took the term the leading edge, and I call it the leading fringe, because what I've discovered is that people that are at the leading edge are usually often some subculture somewhere doing things that you wouldn't pay attention to. But if you'll go out and you'll find them and you'll meet them and you'll take the energy that it takes to understand what they're talking about and then find the ones that are creating the most cutting edge ideas, it will blow your mind. It'll expose you to ways of thinking and models and paradigms and value sets and just ways of approaching reality that are really, really interesting. Some of the ones that I've done in my own life that I've found most interesting, probably actually, close to when I started my business, they started doing singularity summits. I don't know if you've been to those.
No,
I went
to
the first. Okay, I went to the first one. It was in San Jose, and it was like maybe a few hundred people, you know, all getting together and talking about artificial intelligence and robots and when computers wake up and, you know, have sentience and all this. And I had read Ray Kurzweil stuff and really liked his things. And they said they were doing a singularity summit, and so I went. And there was basically nobody like me there from online marketing. It was all people that were into like hardcore technology and, you know, building machines to simulate brains and all this kind of thing. But I met people there and I kept going and I made friends there and I started learning about what they were up to. And still to this day, you know, very good friends from those days. And it totally opened my mind to a new way of thinking, like a new way of looking at reality. They've got new different value sets over there. They really think about rationality and, you know, eliminating bias and so forth. Another one I mentioned, Burning Man.
Let me ask you about the first one. What's the tangible thing then that you got from your life from that? Or did it just send you down a rabbit hole where you just got excited and interested in this futuristic thinking, but it doesn't improve your life? I find that one of the reasons why people are not repulsed, but they stay away from the fringe is they feel weird. They feel like they're never going to be mainstream and it's always going to be this small little interest group. But I feel like you're picking something up from these groups that's more useful.
Or maybe
it just doesn't come out right away and it's the kind of thing that's going to simmer the way that getting into the online world simmered before it did something.
The people that were hanging out at this thing and that were talking, these were people that were building robots and they were building artificial intelligence and they were people that were, you know, that have gone on to become involved in things like blockchain and cryptocurrency. And, you know, in some programs that I've gone to that were pretty fringy, I've met people that are, you know, have gone on to become billionaires, but they were hanging out there, you know, like going to the Summit series, you know, in the early days. It's so what did I get? I mean, I was thinking about artificial intelligence and I've been talking to people about artificial intelligence and what it does. And I'm not a programmer, but I've been talking to people about this for 15 years. I mean, artificial intelligence is just about, that wave is just about to crest in the mainstream. I mean, some huge, what is it, like 10 or 20% of people have one of these things, little Alexa dot that they're talking to. That, you know, your phone, your mobile device right now does all these things. It understands what you're saying. This is all artificial intelligence. Most people are not paying any attention to this. They're not asking, how is artificial intelligence going to change my field? And I've been thinking about it for a long time. And so, you know, I feel like I've got this huge advantage, even though I'm not, you know, I've got a startup that I'm working on right now, and we've been working on it for over a year, and we've got artificial intelligence in there. And I'm learning about building artificial intelligence models are. And I've been learning about like what neural networks are and genetic algorithms. And I don't know what these things are, but what I do know is, you know, one of the guys that I worked with on this, a partner, said, you know, we took this algorithm we made and then we ran it through this system where it automatically generated lots of variations. And then we tried all of those and one of them worked better. And then we took that one and we made variations and one of them worked better. And that's a genetic algorithm. I said, holy cow, you can just have the machine go and make other ones. Because we worked for a long time on the first one. I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. And that's loaded up in my brain. And then I start looking around. I say, this is going to change everything, you know? And so, yeah, you got to go out there and see what's going on. You know, okay.
You were saying Burning Man also. I know that figures a lot into your relationship. That's where you met your wife and to your outlook.
Yeah, Burning Man was a big one for me. I mean, Burning Man's brought a lot of things, but one of them is the art that you see behind me on these walls. It's in, you know, every room in my house. I found the visionary art. I mean, I think that this art and like the book that you just showed right there.
I figured that the book cover had some meaning. It doesn't look like something a book publisher would impose on you. It feels personal to you.
No. I took a lot of time and energy. That cover is by Andrea Jones, who is probably the greatest living visual artist. And in fact, Burning Man just got – the Smithsonian just opened a huge exhibit in Washington, D.C. called No Spectators, The Art of Burning Man. And it's just hitting mainstream right now with all these sculptures, and Andrea Jones has got a whole bunch of his art up there and so forth. So I went to him because I think he's the greatest artist right now. And I said, I want to design a book cover that really captures what opportunity is. And, you know, we worked together on it. This was his concept. And I think we made something special here, you know, the idea of grabbing the lightning. But if you look in there, there's a whole bunch of little images and, you know, there's layered symbology. And getting to know these artists, working with, you know, many of them, five or six of them now are really good friends, collaborating with them on art pieces, on designs. I've learned so much about how to take ideas and represent them visually. You learn things that you just wouldn't learn otherwise until you go and find the people and submerse yourself in the culture.
Really, just get deeply into it.
You got to get into it.
All right.
You got to go meet them. You got to go find them.
I read the book. I recommend it. But here's who I'm going to recommend it to. Anyone who's looking for like an ABC, here's how to find opportunity. Chapter one is going to be an intro. Chapter two will tell you the first step. Chapter three will tell you the next step and so on. That's not this. This is a book where I feel like you've had some really deep thoughts and you said, this is not going to be me talking down to my audience. This is me going to be the way that I would talk to my wife, who you say you fell in love with her brain so much that you got a little jealous of her for being able to thought. This is like, I'm going to have that approach. I'm going to put it out in the world. If it hits, it hits. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I don't care about that. I'm not looking for a sales letter. I'm looking to put something deep in the world. And so anyone who's looking for that, you're going to like this book. Anyone who's looking for, hey, tell me what the first step to finding my opportunity is, you're going to be a little disappointed. Regardless of who you are, I'm going to recommend, if I was the editor, there's one thing that I would do, and I'm going to recommend this to my audience. There is a chapter towards the end of the book. It doesn't have a number, at least in my book, but it's called My Favorite Opportunity in Business. This is the chapter that most people would start their books with, Evan. This is where you say, look, I'm not just teaching this to you because I have these ideas. I'm teaching it to you because look at how my life was shaped by the opportunities that I had. And this is the book, this is the chapter that most people put in the front to say, I have credibility, pay attention to me. You put it at the end, like, look, all this stuff that I just showed you, here's how it influenced my life. Anyone who doesn't know your work should just skip to the back. Don't feel any guilt. There's no teacher telling you how to read this book. Start with that chapter, My Favorite Opportunity in Business, and then go back and understand, here's what I also took away from this book. Some of it you have to walk away from to fully get, because at the time it feels like, oh, yeah, yeah. Then you go, oh, wait a minute. Actually, this really does make sense. And also later on in the book, you get more personal. And I like is now I've gotten to know your thoughts, getting to know your personal life and getting to know how it fits in with all these ideas. So that's the book. It's called Opportunity. I don't know why you don't want people to go to Amazon for it, but you do offer it for free on your website. We could have gotten into that a little bit, but I'll save it for other interviews that you do with other people. You're offering it for free with shipping for anyone
Andrew,
who wants
it's
it.
It's because I don't know how to do Amazon yet. It'll be on there soon. We're going to send some over
figure
to
figure it out.
Well, we are right now. We're literally figuring this out at the last minute. Yeah. That's why.
Yeah. I've got this book yesterday. Yesterday, I think it came in the mail, maybe the day before. So I don't know how you guys are going to be able to get it. But if this is the kind of thought that you want, you've gotten a sense of them, go check it out at Free Opportunity Book, where you can get it, freeopportunitybook.com, where you can get it for free plus shipping. And it might be on Amazon. I'm sure they'll figure it out. I also want to thank my two sponsors for making this happen. The first will host your website, right? It's called hostgator.com/Mixergy. And the second will help you hire your next phenomenal developer. It's called toptal.com/Mixergy, toptal.com/Mixergy. How do you feel this went?
Great. This has been a lot of fun.
Me too. Thanks for being on here. Yeah,
surprisingly, weirdly cool.
Yeah. It wasn't as structured as I thought it would be, but I think that we just kept tapping on things that I found meaningful, and I know the audience will too. But they'll let me know. Cool. Thanks, Evan.